Welcome to the Vet Church Podcast. Vet Church interviews are authentic, sacred, and inspirational. Vet Church is open to anyone who appreciates the sacrifice made by the women and men who put on a uniform and served this great nation. Find out more at vetchurch.com or retiredarmychaplain.com.
Hey, Vet Church, how y'all doing? So I am sitting in the Capitol building. It's not really the Capitol, but it's the
headquarters.
The headquarters for the Seventh-day Adventist
North American Division.
North American Division. And today I'm sitting with Paul Anderson. Now we're going to do another interview this afternoon. And it's another veteran that I didn't work with, but I knew since I was in, and I worked with his wife. But today, right now, right here, right now, I'm with a man that I actually worked with, boots on the ground, so to speak.
Yep.
And you were in the Navy.
Yep. Navy.
You're Navy.
Navy. 26 years.
26 years Navy. We worked at Walter Reed. And we went through the, we were working as chaplains in the hospital, and we did something called clinical pastoral education together.
Right.
Which.
Four units.
But it is no joke. It's kind of like, they say it's kind of like Ranger School for chaplains, where they just beat you down and then build you back up. Actually, they help you. It's kind of, I always saw CPE kind of like the story of the, you know, the guy walks along and he sees the Buddhist monk chiseling this beautiful sculpture. He's like, man, you're creating something awesome. And the monk looks at him and he's like, oh no, I'm not creating anything. I'm chiseling away. The creation was already there. And I think that's what CPE does. Yeah. So we're both retired, and you now do something that is. So I want to explain this for the group, because some folks don't. They see chaplains in the military and they think, well, a chaplain goes in just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. When I was an assistant, I did. I went down to the basic training place and I raised my hand with the recruiter and blah blah blah. Then again at Fort Benning, and then I went to AIT. Mm-hmm. But when I became a chaplain candidate, and it was totally different because my first contact was somebody called an endorser or an endorsing agent, a handler. Mm-hmm. And you're that for the Seventh-day Adventist, for all the Seventh-day Adventist chaplains.
Correct. So I'm the endorser. I'm the director of Adventist Chaplaincy Ministries. That's the endorsing agency for Seventh-day Adventist chaplains in general. Whether it's healthcare, corrections, community, police, fire, we are all there. And we have about 104 Adventist chaplains in the military, active and reserves.
Wow. What about in your hospitals? The Seventh-day Adventist has tons of hospitals,
yeah,
right?
We endorse right now. We have 700 and a few endorsed chaplains across North America. Most of them are working in hospitals, either in Adventist healthcare systems or we got some in VA and other hospitals, private hospitals around the country.
You know, as I would cruise along, and some of y'all out there in Vet Church have said to me, who takes care of you, chaplain? Who do you talk to?
That's what the endorser is for.
That's what this guy would do for the Seventh-day Adventist chaplains.
I'm the pastor for my chaplains.
Yeah. And it's almost mind-boggling. Because if you think of it, like, as a chaplain, at points, I took care of several hundred people. Mm. Even working with Walter Reed, you know, sometimes you get you're the weekend guy and everything falls on you.
Right.
And so you're taking care of people that take care of hundreds of other people and love them and care for them and pray with them and cry with them and weep with them. Mm-hmm. And then all the chaplains are people too.
Yes.
As y'all know about me, I mean, I'm just another guy. And you can see it. Like, sometimes it's a little rough, you know, and sometimes it's not polished. Mm-hmm. And you sitting here in this beautiful suit, but I know you, and I know it's not all polished. You're a regular guy.
Yeah. I go where my people are, and I'm a married man, 37 years, two kids, four grandchildren, and that's where the humanity is.
It's the ups and downs of real life.
Real life. Yeah, man. 37 years of marriage, 20 of them while on active duty in the military. So you know deployments. I did 7 consecutive years as a GEO bachelor. Imagine that.
Now explain GEO bachelor for some of, because you know we have in Vet Church and in our tribe we have people that were not in the military but care about people in the military. We have, I don't know how many people say to me, well, my dad or my uncle or my brother was in, but I don't really understand it. Hmm. Can you explain the GEO bachelor? Because that's a term we use a lot.
Right. So a GEO bachelor is somebody who's been assigned to a duty station and the spouse or family doesn't relocate with them. So in my case, we settled here in Maryland, and then the Navy sent me on board a guided missile cruiser out of Norfolk, Virginia. Well, my wife was employed here and my kids were in high school and college, so we needed that second income. And the ship was gone 72% of the year, and I was assigned to it for 2 years, so it really didn't make sense for her to move. So I lived in Norfolk on board the ship, actually bought an RV, so that when the ship was in port, I could get off.
And you know,
when we got ready to pull out again, I parked the RV in the storage lot and ride my bike back to the ship. And that's how we did. After the ship, the Navy sent me to postgraduate school at Boston University. Well, that's 1 year. So we didn't move. I drove the RV up to Boston and I lived in that. I'd come home on the weekends. After that, they sent me overseas to Bahrain for a 1 year unaccompanied tour. So by the time I got back from Bahrain, I'd been gone from home 4 consecutive years. And instead of sending me home to Maryland, the Navy, because it needs the Navy, I went to Jacksonville, Florida for 3 years.
So you're basically 7 years gone.
7 years. I would get home on the weekends most of the time, but you're still coming home on the weekends. You're catching up from all the time you spent away. And the benefit was my wife, we had a mature marriage. My kids were in their teens and 20s. So our family was solid. We survived. But there were ups and downs. There were bumps and crashes in the midst of all of that. And particularly when you are a chaplain and you're dealing pastorally with people who are in crisis or coming out of crisis or going through things. We had helicopter crashes, you know, casualties, suicides, people getting married, people getting divorced, people going to jail, all of that. And the chaplain becomes the pulse point for people in crisis. And how do you deal with that? And then especially when you come off of a deployment where you had casualties.
It's a lot of loss.
A lot of loss.
It's personal loss.
A lot of loss. And if you're away from home, and that might be good, because sometimes people process their loss, their grief, their trauma inappropriately and sometimes violently with family members. So in my case, we didn't have that because I was gone. But what did I have? Because drinking was not a thing for me. Smoking, my background, I never acclimated to that. So what do you do? You know, you. For me, I could exercise, but only to a point. I had to sink deep in faith to keep me from becoming aberrant in other areas. You know, they say the things that get the preachers are the wine, women, and song. I don't sing and I don't drink. So,
well, here we go.
But God kept me. And guarded me and kept me from my own humanity. And my family was able to survive without a whole lot of drama, thank God. Kept me from myself, kept me from the women who might have been willing.
Well, in you know, it's our tribe. I remember a statistic, in, I think it was 2014, the VA said that in our tribe, veterans, in active duty altogether. But they said not in the veteran community, I'm sorry. In the active duty for E5 and below in the Army in 2014, they said it was 80% divorce rate.
I mean, wow.
It's easy to, especially as a chaplain, you know, like we deal with emotion. Mm-hmm. And you and I have both, we're still in faithful marriages. Mm-hmm. Where we're like, I, my friends aren't there. I've got a lot of friends that it was actually better for them to leave because whatever happened.
Right.
And, you know, it's a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. you're just sitting here processing for a second, you being gone that amount of time. Now, I know that, well, you were able to afford an RV because you were, I don't know the rank structure in the Navy very well.
Well, I got it when I was in 03. God blessed, it was a miracle, really. We found it on the lemon lot on a base. And the couple who was selling it, they were godly people, and they weren't trying to get what it was worth. They were just trying to get what they needed to pay it off.
That's a miracle. And, well, the other thing is, you got privates in the same, the lower, you know, people of lower rank that don't have the money to even buy something like that. True. Going through the exact same things.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then as a chaplain, those youngsters come to you, and sometimes they're not young. Sometimes they're the same age. They just got in the military later in life and right. things, and they look at you, and your heart breaks, or my heart did. Mm-hmm. And from sitting with you in Walter Reed, I know yours did too.
Oh yeah.
And we take upon. I mean, when you sit with somebody, you don't just sit there and go like, "Oh yeah, that's horrible."
Well, see, you know, the chaplains don't just sit with people. We go with them.
Yes.
So, you know, you're more than a pastor. You're part of a unit. And every unit relies upon its people to do their function. And our function is to help our people find and keep their balance. And in order to do that, sometimes you got to hold, and so they know that we are with them, and we experience what they've experienced, the explosions, the shipwrecks, been through two of those, and
shipwreck,
yeah,
like in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, I was on an aircraft carrier years ago. The USS Midway, we were getting ready to pull into Singapore the next morning. And middle of the night, we got hit by a ship that was carrying, it was a freighter, flagged out of Panama. And apparently no one was on the bridge. And generally, warships don't change course. And we got hit. Two people killed. Airplanes just wiped off, just dragged off the back of the ship. Mm. Others damaged such that we had to push them overboard because they were they were worthless. Tails broken off and stuff. But we lost two people.
And that's a huge, I mean, we're talking, when you say ship, we're talking like gymnasium after gymnasium after gymnasium, throw a few football fields
yeah.
And it's like this huge structure.
Mm-hmm.
How does somebody hit something like that?
Nobody's steering the other ship. And so that was, you know, I had a guy, young fella, jump overboard. He just had a psychotic break and jumped overboard in the middle of the ocean. Now, when that happens on a Navy ship, the ship stops and turns around to go back to the point where the person went overboard. I mean, and it's a well-oiled man overboard drill. But because of the way this happened, half the ship was up on the deck when this kid jumped overboard. And we had a guy, as we were backing up, we had a guy who actually got in the water to try to save him. And we saw this guy just, you know, maybe a couple of pulls and kicks away from being able to rescue this kid, and the kid puts his hands up and sinks. There are 360 people on a cruiser. There's one chaplain. And everybody was affected by that. And I was there.
So you were there too.
I was there.
So not only are you their chaplain, but you're a person, man.
Yeah, he broke away from me to jump overboard. So the whole ship is traumatized. The captain, the XO, the master chief, and everybody.
What do you mean he broke away from you?
He'd had a break, and actually it's online, so people who are interested, look up USS Monterey. If you look that up somewhere in there, you'll find a story. I'll tell the name. His name is Christian Early. Wow, this was like 12 years ago. And we had just been talking. He was down in my office and we were talking. And he was kind of a strange bird aboard the ship. But in that particular conversation, I think there was a moment when his soul was crying out for salvation. And I recognized that, and I opened that door for him. You know what? God's got what you need. And I will never forget him saying to me, I think you might be right, Chaplain, but there's this girl back home I want to make a run at. And I know if I accept God, he's not going to allow me to do that. I said, you got to make a choice. Right about that time, over the 1MC, they were calling for him. That's the interior communication system. They made a call for him, and I had a meeting. So I went to the meeting with the CO and others. And in the meeting, phone rings. Phone never rings when you're in the, you know, the wardroom with the captain for the, you know, but it rang.
The Army.
And he picks up the phone and he says, what? Now? And he hands me the phone. Chaplain, they want you. And I'm like, okay, so I get the phone. It's the chief yeoman for the ship. He's like, chaps, we need you. You got to get out here to the forecastle ASAP. And so, when I hang up the phone, I'm telling the CO I got to go. And he said, well, what's the problem? I didn't exactly know because they didn't say. And he said, well, how come I don't know about whatever this is? I don't know, but I got to go. And he says, well, get back to me. As I'm going out, over the interior communication system, I hear security alert, security alert, deranged sailor with weapons on the aft missile deck. A guided missile cruiser is 372 feet, about 360 feet long, 72 feet wide. And so I was going to the front. Now, that's three football fields. I'm going to the front, to the forecastle, and they do this announcement. So I go out, and I know it's this guy. I just knew it. And I go running back three football fields, or a football field, 300, and running to the back of the ship, and there he is. This kid had two Gurkha knives. You know what?
That's I got one in the safe.
So he's got two. Now, clearly he's intent on harming something. So I'm the first one there. Weapons officer comes back, and he looks at him. And now, on a ship, when they call a security alert, that means that something bad's fitting to happen. There's an encroachment on the ship. So the security team, designated security team, goes and arms up. I mean, this happens like in 35, 40 seconds.
Yeah.
And then they go and neutralize the threat. So I'm out there, and I know what's fixing to happen, and I don't want to see him get shot. He probably knew what was going to happen, too. And so I stayed out there with him, but in a distance far enough. I figured, you know, I could probably disarm him with one, but two.
Because y'all don't know, like, I do have a Gurkha, and it's not in my safe, it's in my, well, now that we only have one little unit. I think the knife even might be with my brother, but I'd use it for when we had our lawn service. You can cut a sapling down like that, like whack. And they're great for, like, it's like a machete, but it'll sever an arm or a leg like that. Mm-hmm. And they're the Gurkhas from the
Mount Nepal.
Nepal's army, those guys are... Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the dangerous situation.
Disembowel somebody in one swipe. So I just kept talking to him, and so he was a target. But for whatever reason, I think because I was there, they didn't fire. And I was able to persuade him to put them down. And what I expected was going to happen was that the corpsman would have been out there to hit him with massive Thorazine, and then we would. But they didn't. They were there, and I'm sure they had it. But they thought I had him under control. I didn't have hands on him or anything, but I went out there, and when he put them down, I did actually. We embraced. And he's crying. I said, okay, well, now you will get what you certainly wanted. You wanted off the ship. That's going to happen. But we need to go inside. So we start inside. And he stopped. And he said, you know what, chaps, I'm thirsty. I said, get some water inside. Let's go. And he just bolted. Now, imagine security alert. The guys are... And everybody who... wasn't fully occupied was out there watching.
Yeah.
And he just jumped off the back of the ship.
And you know, it's wild because we're talking about in you know, it's from an army guy's perspective, that thing's massive. I mean,
30 some feet above the water.
And all of a sudden, the guy that was a threat a minute ago, now everybody's trying to save. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, I liked it. I'm saying I'm romantic, but I think I'm a little more mystical. Maybe when he puts his hands up, he's looking to Christ.
That could be.
We'll never know.
Yeah, he certainly was giving up on life, but it could have been an into thy hands, I commend my spirit. Yeah, we'll never know. Night falls, and I got 359 traumatized people.
And yourself.
Paul,
you're traumatized.
I'm the 350. Well,
even the way you said he broke from me, I was like, hang on a second.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe I should have had hands on him, but, that's hindsight.
People, man. Like, it's like, we try so hard to treat each other with dignity.
Mm-hmm. Especially the chaplain has to treat everybody with dignity. In fact, part of the reason we found out later why he had that break was because when his name was called into a situation with senior leaders who had no regard for his humanity. But anyway, yeah.
Well, so. And it's interesting that now you're the guy that's like, I mean, I took a knife from a young man. I got called out in the middle of the night. He's drinking. And I got the knife out of his hands. MP's come rushing in the door and he grabs the knife again. Mm-hmm. And it was a big mess.
Mm-hmm.
But I was, fortunately, I took the knife out of his hands again. And then I looked at that, like, and then life went on. Like, well, that was just what Chapman did.
Yeah.
No, and nobody, my endorsing agent at that time, nobody ever knew about it. My wife knows about it, and the people that were there, my mm-hmm. chapel assistant knew about it. But nobody ever even talked about it. It was just kind of like one of those things, well, yeah, that kind of happened.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
Yep.
Move on.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have this responsibility, may I say, opportunity and privilege of caring for this group of military chaplains, hospital chaplains. This stuff happens in hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, when we worked the psych ward, mm-hmm. I think you worked the psych ward at Walter Reed. Mm-hmm. I did too. You see some wild stuff go down because people are people. They're real. They're we hurt. We bleed on the inside without shedding blood. Mm. Our souls cry out for something that's real.
Yeah. And sometimes it's humorous after the fact. I remember being up on the psych ward. I came up on a Sunday to visit the patients, and there were some they were playing, and I guess they needed somebody else to play Sorry, the board game.
Yeah.
And so this guy comes up, "Chaps, you got time? Why don't you join us in a game of Sorry?" Benign little game, right? And of course, you don't know these people unless, you know, and at that time, I hadn't, because I was going to do a service. I wasn't going to visit specific patients, so I hadn't looked at their records.
Sure.
I'm just there, you know. So we sit down to play Sorry, and, you know, part of that is you get a 2, and then you can get to go again. If you get a 1 and a 4, then you can back up. And so we're playing a game, and I'd gotten sorried and put back in my circle a time or two, and this guy was right there. I got a 1. And he had 2, 1 here and 1 there. And so I came out and I put him in, and I got a 4. So I slid back and I took his other man and put it in. And he looked at me. He said to me, "I'd F you up right here."
There's Sunday morning visit for you.
And I said, it just kind of came out. I said, "Well, you could try, but this really isn't worth all that. Let's just keep up the game." And at that moment, this orderly came by and said, "Okay, man, that's enough. That's enough." And the guy says to me, "You know I'm in here for killing people."
There we go.
That's humorous now.
At the time.
So the orderly said, "Chaps, you better go now, because he's ramping up, and it's not going to be pretty." And I said, "Well, look, man, thanks for letting me play. I didn't realize that the game you were inviting me to play was going to be all that. But let me shake your hand, and let me say a prayer with you." And he looked at me. There was death in his eyes. And he looked at me, and I looked at him. You know, and strangely, I don't think I'd ever seen that particular, you know, it's one thing to see somebody angry or to get in a fight with somebody. It's another thing to see a war-hardened warrior with that, you know. And I don't think I'd seen that before. I've seen it since. But I held his gaze, and then it changed. And he put his hand out, and I shook his hand, and I held it with both my hands. It's a two-handed shake. And I said a prayer and prayed for him specifically, that God would bind that spirit of evil that would rise up so quickly in him and heal his wounded spirit. I remember that. And then I said amen. And he started crying. His hands in my hand, he would have killed me 30 seconds ago. But he's crying. And I just stayed there. There's no class in seminary to tell you what to do in that kind of situation. But I never let go of his hand until he let go. And he said, "Thank you," and turned around, and they walked him to his room. But he was sedate. What they were getting ready to do was take him there and sedate him. I'm sorry, I said he was sedate. He was serene. They would have sedated him.
If he had known.
Well, because he had that.
His prayer was real.
The prayer made the difference.
And I want to go further. All the way back to the beginning of this conversation. You were there, man. You sat down with him.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You were there.
And 2 other guys.
It was real.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you didn't run away.
Yeah. We don't get to share our stories as chaplains. And, you know, if you can find something on the internet that is not, it's not, definitely right. Not in the secure realm anyway. But you and I have both done stuff that we can't talk about. and you almost can't talk about that story, you know, but you honored Early. Mm-hmm. You honored him by telling his story, and you honored him by being there with him. You know, they talk about ministry of presence, and I'll never forget, like, when I first heard of this guy, I said, well, what do I do? Just walk down the hall and everybody's healed because I'm here, you know? But that ain't it. No. Ministry of presence is being there in the board game.
Right.
Because you never would have prayed for him if you hadn't played sorry.
Right. And if I'd been too busy or seemed to be too busy and uncaring, that might have been a transformational moment in his life that would have been missed if I was too busy.
And you could have been in other places. You got a family. Mm-hmm. 37 years of giving of yourself. I mean, I was only chaplain for, what, 5-6 years, Kate? Something. Yeah. And I remember feeling so broken at times, and that no, you know, I'd go talk to a regular pastor. Man, their life was so different than mine. You know?
Yeah.
And you're taking care of hundreds of us. And every denomination has chaplains.
Oh, yeah.
And every denomination has a man or a woman just like you in this position.
Let me tell you another funny story. So we've been at sea for 6 months. We'd had a couple of ports, but we were on the way home. And, you know, every night on a Navy ship, the chaplain does a prayer. And, I mean, it's over the 1MC, you know, the bosun, if they use the pipe, they'll blow the pipe, attention to prayer, and the chaplain comes on. Everybody stops for that 30 seconds to a minute, 90 seconds if you're long-winded, but most of the time you don't want to go that long. They stop for that prayer, and it's meaningful. It really is a punctuation in the rhythm of the ship. Every night I'd go up there, there was this guy who would meet me. He was, he worked up there. And he was,
yeah, he'd be along with you, man.
He was Wiccan. Okay. Now, I'm Seventh-day Adventist.
Polar opposite.
He would want to talk every night. He was raised Southern Baptist, and you know, he went away, and but he would challenge me with questions, or we would just have conversations, you know. But he's Wiccan. So we pull in port in the Seychelles Islands, and I was going to meet a local pastor to have lunch and then go do a radio interview. I'm walking down the street, and this guy calls me, Hey Chaps. And I look over, and it's him, right? He's, come here, man, come here. And he wasn't drunk. He was, you know, in the...
He wasn't drunk because most of the sailors are drunk when they get a chance to get off that boat.
Right. Okay. And they want to redeem their lives, what they've missed. But he wasn't drunk. And he calls me over to introduce me to this gorgeous woman. She wasn't dressed. She didn't have on much clothing, which led me to realize that she was an entrepreneur and hooker. So he introduced me as the chaplain, right? Who does that? Mm-hmm. And he said, this is my chaplain. So I'm a Seventh-day Adventist chaplain, but I'm on this ship. And on that ship, you're everybody's chaplain. No matter what their faith group is,
chaplain.
I was his chaplain, and he introduced me as his chaplain. She said, "Well, what is a chaplain?" He said, "Well, it's like a pastor, and we're his flock." And
it's true, man.
She looked and she said, "What is your faith group? Your background?" I said, "Well, I'm Seventh-day Adventist, but he's Wiccan. But I'm his chaplain." She looked at him and she said, "You're Wiccan." And she looked at me and she said, "You're Seventh-day Adventist." I said, "I am." She said, "That doesn't make any sense to me." I said, "Well, it does if you understand our culture." But then she said, the look came over her face, and she said, And then she reached in her little top and she took out the money he'd evidently given her and said,
I'm sorry, I can't do this. Gave him the money back and ran off. And he said, Chaps, what did you do?
What did you do? You gave her something. You gave her something, man. Because, like, maybe for a minute you gave her hope.
I think so.
And you,
in fact, I know so.
You gave him enough love that he owned the relationship that he was in with you. Mm-hmm.
Because of that relationship. I did not diminish his humanity. I just showed him genuine spiritual love and care. And with her, strangely enough, I was preaching at an Adventist church the next day. And afterward, this woman greet, you know, you stand at the door and shake hands. Woman comes and she says, do you remember me? No, I'm sorry, I've never been here before. She says, oh, but we met. And I'm like, but I know who I met. And then it rang a bell and she said, God sent you. And that conversation we had brought me under conviction. And I will never be out there again.
Paul Anderson, that's the story of Jesus and the woman at the well. Mm-hmm. Y'all don't know the story, man. It's great. Like, Christ first miracle, he turns water into wine. And then he goes to the water. He needs some water. He's thirsty.
Goes to the well.
And he goes to this well. And a woman that comes down and serves him. And he says, you don't have just one husband. You got a bunch. Five.
Mm-hmm. And the one you have now.
Ain't your husband.
Which might have meant six. Maybe he was the fifth. Maybe.
And maybe she was just making some money.
Or but maybe Christ she was broken.
Loved her.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. He went to her house.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And she brought her friends to him because that thing, that experience was transformational for her. And it restored the Imago Dei that had been rubbed off. Perhaps she had been sexually abused as a child, or maybe the only currency she had was her beauty. And who knows? But that experience with Christ at the well gave her hope, restoration, and reconciliation with her community. Because the story says she went back and she told people, never has such a man spoken like this, and brought them out to see her. Wow. So she's now bringing people to see this rock star, this Messiah who could know all of the layers of her life and not condemn her, but give her restoration.
And we used the word Imago Dei just a second ago. It's Latin for the image of God. Mm-hmm. And every single person is made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm. Every single
person. If you're breathing, you're made in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, like, I never feel worthy to be here, like, with you. You know, like, my language is usually pretty rough. I'm playing bars.
But you're doing the work of the Lord.
Well, I'm made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a relationship with Jesus Christ. And in the truth of the matter is, somebody asked Christ, hey, why don't you go over there to those, you know, the people that I got it all together, they're all clean, it's chrome, it's stainless, it's beautiful, the big houses, the wealth.
Mm.
And he says, hey, I don't know, what do they need a Savior for?
Mm.
and that's what you did. Like, I mean, you had a relationship with a guy, and you valued him as a person in the image of God.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he didn't believe anything. In fact, he would believe that everything you believe is full of crap, you know? And yet, through your love of him, you loved somebody that was looking for love, for real love, not just for a couple of bucks.
Yep.
Now, there's people in this world that are, I mean, human trafficking is enormous. Yeah. Prostitution is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Pornography is, it's not all consensual.
No.
A lot of it's done through slavery. It's mm-hmm. real. These are real things that are going on. And there are people that are like, hey, I got no money and I got to feed my kids and I will have sex to do that. Mm-hmm. Those are rarer than we... there's plenty of food in this world right now.
I was over in Kenya a couple of years ago. And we went up to Kisumu, which is right on the banks of Lake Victoria. And one evening, we were down by the piers there, because Lake Victoria is huge, and there you have a lot of fish in there. Africa, as verdant a place as it is.
Verdant, what's that mean?
A lot of growth. Okay. You know, stuff grows there. You know, mango trees and just...
fruit.
Yeah. I mean,
vegetable, yeah.
But there's still poverty and hunger. And there are... all over the world, there are more female babies that survive than male babies. So there are more women in the world than men. Which means that even in cultures where polygamy is practiced, there will be women without men, whose fathers or brothers have died and they don't have husbands. There's a phenomenon there of fish wives.
What do you mean?
These are women whose husbands may have died or left them, and they don't have enough resources to supply themselves or their children food. So they go down to the pier and wait for the ships to come in and make themselves available for fish so that they can eat.
Sad, man. And it, you know, and when you this man and myself believe that you know, women can do whatever men can do, we've seen mm-hmm. it in the military. We are not the guys that are like, oh, you know, you gotta have a man. That's not what Paul was saying. I know that from it just, it's not who we are.
Mm-hmm.
There are cultures mm-hmm. where women are still considered property.
Right.
And women are treated as less than.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as objects for sexual release.
And so our folks in the American service, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, are being exposed to this as they travel around the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cost of freedom, because in their minds something's happening, and they come back in America and we see a culture that is barely getting treating women right, barely.
Mm-hmm.
We have extreme cases of people that were in power that have abused that power over and over and over. We've watched the news. We've heard the leaders be so absolutely.
And this is not a political thing.
Not at all.
It's not a Democrat. It's not a Republican. There are abuses of marginalized people that happen in every community. From the wealthiest to the poorest.
Mm-hmm.
And that abuse probably is stimulated because of where poverty abounds, sometimes the grace of God is not as evident. But the Bible says where sin doth abound, grace doth abound all the more. And it is our job to be carriers of that grace wherever we are.
Let's talk about that a minute. Carriers of grace. How does a person in Opelika, Alabama, with a small Walmart, a Dairy Queen, and a McDonald's, there ain't a whole lot of jobs out there.
Mm.
How do you show grace? It's a couple of churches. Alabama, they won't even let you have medical marijuana.
Mm.
I mean, we're talking, there's some oppression going on. There's some great people there, too. I mean, it's just the way it is right now, you know? I mean, what do you do? How do you have grace in, say, Opelika, Alabama?
That's a good question. And let me just segue back. When I was down to see you, that time I was the night before, I was driving up to one of the bases in Alabama, but I had landed in Florida. And you know there's still sunset communities?
I don't know what that is.
That's where, if you're black, you're not supposed to be in that community after dark.
Wasn't aware.
I was pulled
into a gas station. I rented a car. It was a Mustang. And so I just needed some gas, and I pulled in there, and it was getting near sunset. And I'm pumping gas in the car, and these young guys drive through, maybe in the 30-ish, and they pulled through and stopped. And then they pulled out, and then they came back. When they came back, I realized right at that, you know how you feel stuff. I said, this might be a problem. And they just rolled back by the pump, and one of the guys said, you know the sun's setting here.
He said that to you?
Yeah. And I said, I'll be finished here momentarily. And, I mean, that was a throwback to, now I'm 60, so I lived through the 50s and the 60s, so, but that was a throwback. Now, so in addition to the picture you painted, how do you show grace in that regard? And I think it's looking at everybody and not seeing the immediate circumstance, but seeing the soul. And when we can look at people, no matter where they are, no matter what they've done, and see that this is a soul for whom Christ has died, it takes the sting out of some of the responses that you get in life, or it adds a certain amount of sensitivity to seeing people, and you say, what can I do? What can I do?
Thank you for joining us for this Vet Church interview. Your feedback is welcome. Find out more at vetchurch.com or retiredarmychaplain.com.